Lindsay and the Red City Blues. The ancient Red City of Marrakesh, his guidebook said, is the last large oasis for travelers moving south into the Sahara. It is the most exotic of Moroccan cities where Arab Africa and Black Africa meet, in a setting that has changed but little in the past 1,000 years. In mid-afternoon, the book did not mention, it becomes so hot that even the flies stop moving. The air conditioner in his window hummed impressively, but neither moved nor cooled the air. He had complained 3 times, and the desk clerk responded with 2 shrugs and a blank stare. By 2 o'clock, his little warren was unbearable. He fled to the street, where it was hotter. Scott Lindsay was a salesman who demonstrated chemical glassware for a large scientific supply house in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Like all Washingtonians, Lindsay thought that a person who could survive summer on the banks of the Potomac could survive it anywhere. He saved up 6 weeks of vacation time and flew to Europe in late July. Paris was pleasant enough, and the Pyrenees were even cool, but nobody had told him that on August 1st, all of Europe goes on vacation. Every good hotel room has been sewed up for 6 months. Restaurants are jammed or closed, and you spend all your time making bad travel connections to cities where only the most expensive hotels have accommodations. In Nice, a Canadian said he had just come from Morocco, where it was hotter than hell, but there were practically no tourists this time of year. Scott looked wistfully over the poisoned but still blue Mediterranean, felt the pressure of 20 million fellow travelers at his back, remembered Bogey, and booked the next flight to Casablanca. Casablanca combined the charm of Pittsburgh with the climate of Dallas. The still air was thick with dust from high-rise construction. He picked up a guidebook and riffled through it, and on the basis of a few paragraphs, took the pre-dawn train to Marrakesh. The Red City, it went on, takes its name from the color of the local sandstone from which the city and its ramparts were built. It would be more accurate, Scott reflected, though less alluring, to call it the Pink City, the Dirty Pink City. He stumbled along the sidewalk on the shady side of the street. The 12-inch strip of shade at the edge of the sidewalk was crowded with sleeping beggars. The heat was so dry he couldn't even sweat. He passed 2 bars that were closed and stepped gratefully into a third. It was a Muslim bar, a milk bar. No booze, but at least it was shade. 2 young men slumped at the bar, arguing in guttural whispers, and a pair of ancients in burnouses sat at a table playing a static game of checkers. An oscillating fan pushed the hot air and dust around. He raised a finger at the bartender, who regarded him with stolid hostility and ordered, in schoolboy French, a small bottle of Vichy water, carbonated without ice, and out of deference to the guidebook, a glass of hot mint tea. The bartender brought the mint tea and a liter bottle of Sidi Harazim water, not carbonated, with a glass of ice. Scott tried to argue with the man, but he only stared and kept repeating the price. He finally paid and dumped the ice, which the guidebook had warned him about, into the ashtray. The young men at the bar watched the transaction with sleepy indifference. The mint tea was an aromatic infusion of mint leaves and hot sugar water. He sipped and was surprised and perversely annoyed to find it quite pleasant. He took a paperback novel out of his pocket and read the same 2 paragraphs over and over, feeling his eyes track, unable to concentrate in the heat. He put the book down and looked around with slow deliberation, trying to be impressed by the alienness of the place. Through the open front of the bar, he could see across the street, where a small park shaded the outskirts of the Jemaa El Fanah, the largest open-air market in Morocco and, according to the guidebook, the most exciting and colorful, which itself was the gateway to the mysterious labyrinthine Medina, where even this moment someone was being murdered for his pocket change. Goats were being used in ways of which Allah did not approve. Men were smoking a mixture of camel dung and opium. Children were merchandised like groceries, where dark men and women would do anything for a price, and the price would not be high. Scott touched his pocket unconsciously, and the hard bulge of the condom was still there. The best condoms in the world are packaged in a blue plastic cylinder, squared off along the prolate axis about the size of a small matchbox. The package is a marvel of technology, held fast by a combination of geometry and sticky tape. And a cool-headed man, under good lighting conditions, can open it in less than a minute. Scott had bought six of them in the drugstore in Dulles International, and had opened only one. He hadn't opened it for the Parisian woman, who had looked like a prostitute, but had returned his polite proposition with a storm of outrage. He opened it for the fat customs inspector at the Casablanca airport, who had to have its function explained to him, who held it between two dainty fingers like a Dead Sea thing, and called his compatriots over for a look. The Jemaah El Fanah was closed against the heat, pale orange, dusty, tense, slack and pallid in the stillness. And the trees through which he stared at the open-air market, the souk, were also covered with pale dust. The sky was so pale as to be almost white, and the street and sidewalk were the color of dirty chalk. It was like a faded watercolor displayed under too strong a light. "Hey, mister," a slim Arab boy, evidently in his early teens, had slipped into the place and was standing beside Lindsay. He was well scrubbed and wore Western-style clothing, discreetly patched. "Hey, mister," he repeated, "you American?"
"No, I've been Yugoslav."
The boy nodded.
"You from New York?" "I got four friends New York."
"Yugoslav."
"You from Chicago?" "I got four friends Chicago." "No, five. Five friends Chicago."
"Yugoslav," he said.
"Where in U.S. you from?"
He took a melting ice cube from the ashtray, buffed it on his sleeve, popped it into his mouth, crunched. "New Caledonia," Scott said.
"Don't like ice? Ice is good this time day."
He repeated the process with another cube.
"New what?" he mumbled.
"New Caledonia, little place in the Rockies between Georgia and Wisconsin. I don't like polluted ice."
"No, mister, this ice okay. Bottle water ice."
He rattled off a stream of Arabic at the bartender, who answered with a single harsh syllable.
"Come on, I guide you through Medina."
"No."
"I guide you free. Student, English student. I take you free, take you my father's factory."
"You'll take me, all right."
"Okay, we go now. No tourist shit, make good deal."
"Well, Lindsay, you wanted experiences. How about being knocked over the head and raped by a goat?"
"All right, I'll go, but no pay." "Sure, no pay."
He took Scott by the hand and dragged him out of the bar into the park.
"Is there any place in the Medina where you can buy cold beer?"
"Sure, lots of place. Ice beer. You got cigarette?"
"Don't smoke."
"That's okay. You buy pack up here."
He pointed at a gazebo-shaped concession on the edge of the park.
"Hell no. You find me a beer and I might buy you some cigarettes."
They came out of the shady park and crossed the packed earth plaza of the Jemaah El Fanah. Dust stung his throat and nostrils, but it wasn't quite as hot as it had been earlier. A slight breeze had come up. One industrious merchant was rolling up the front flap of his tent, exposing racks of leather goods. He called out, "Hey, you buy!" But Scott ignored him, and the boy made a fist gesture, thumb erect between the two first fingers. Scott had missed one section of the guidebook. Never visit the Medina without a guide. The streets are laid out in crazy, unpredictable angles, and someone who doesn't live there will be hopelessly lost in minutes. The best guides are the older men or young Americans who live there for the cheap narcotics. With them, you can arrange the price ahead of time, usually about 5 dirham, $1.10. Under no circumstances, hire one of the street urchins who pose as students and offer to guide you for free. You will be cheated or even beaten up and robbed. They passed behind the long double row of tents and entered the Medina through the Bab Anu gateway. The main street of the place was a dirt alley some 8 feet wide, flanked on both sides by small shops and stalls, most of which were closed, either with curtains or steel shutters or with the proprietor dozing on the stoop. None of the shops had a wall on the side fronting the alley, but the ones that served food usually had chest-high counters. If they passed an open shop, the merchant would block their way and importune them in urgent, simple French or English, plucking at Scott's sleeve as they passed.
It was surprisingly cool in the Medina, the sun's rays partially blocked by wooden lattices suspended over the alleyway. There was a roast chestnut smell of semolina being parched, with accents of garlic and strange herbs smoldering. Slight tang of exhaust fumes and sickly sweet hint of garbage and sewage hidden from the sun. The boy led him down a side street, and then another. Scott couldn't tell the position of the sun and was quickly disoriented. "Where the hell are we going?" "Cold beer, you see." He plunged down an even smaller alley, dark and sinister, and Lindsay followed, feeling unarmed. They huddled against a damp wall while a white-haired man on an antique one-cylinder motor scooter hammered by. "How much farther is this place?" "I'm not going to..." "Here, one corner." The boy dragged him around the corner and into a musty-smelling dark shop. The shopkeeper, small and round, smiled gold teeth and greeted the boy by name, Abdul. "The word for beer is bira," he said. Scott repeated the word to the fat little man, and Abdul added something. The man opened two beers and set them down on the counter along with a pack of cigarettes. "It's a new little Arab, Lindsay, but I think you'll be amused by its presumption." He paid and gave Abdul his cigarettes and beer. "Aren't you Muslim? I thought Muslims didn't drink." "Hell yes, man." He stuck his finger down the neck of the bottle and flicked away a drop of beer, then tilted the bottle up and drained half of it in one gulp. Lindsay sipped at his. It was warm and sour. "What you do in the States, man?" He lit a cigarette and held it awkwardly. "Chemical glassware salesman?" "I drive a truck." The acrid Turkish tobacco smoke stung his eyes. "Make lots of money?" "No, I don't." He felt foolish saying it. "World traveler, Lindsay, you spent more on your ticket than this boy will see in his life." "Let's go my father's factory." "What does your father make?" "All kinds of things. Rugs." "I wouldn't know what to do with a rug." "We wrap it, mail to New Caledonia." "No. Let's go back to..." "I take you my uncle's factory. Brass, very pretty." "No. Back to the plaza. You got your cig..." "Sure, let's go." He gulped down the rest of his beer and stepped back into the alley, Scott following. After a couple of twists and turns, they passed an antique weapons shop that Scott knew he would have noticed if they'd come by it before. He stopped. "Where are you taking me now?" He looked hurt. "Back to Jama El Fana, like you say." "The hell you are. Get lost, Abdul. I'll find my own way back." He turned and started retracing their path. The boy followed about 10 paces behind him, smoking. He walked for 20 minutes or so, trying to find the relatively broad alleyway that would lead back to the gate. The character of the Medina changed. There were fewer and fewer places selling souvenirs, and then none. Only residences and little general merchandise stores, and some small craft factories where one or two men working at a feverish pace cranked out the items that were sold in the shops. No one tried to sell him anything, and when a little girl held out her hand to beg, an old woman shuffled over and slapped her. Everybody stared when he passed. Finally, he stopped and let Abdul catch up with him. "All right, you win. How much to lead me out?" 10 dirham. "Stuff it. I'll give you 2. Abdul looked at him for a long time, hands in pockets. 9 dirham. They haggled for a while and finally settled on 7 dirham, about $1.50. Half now and half at the gate. They walked through yet another part of the Medina, single file through narrow streets. Abdul smoking silently, in the lead. Suddenly he stopped. Scott almost ran into him. "Say, you want girl?"
"I'm not sure," Scott said, startled into honesty.
He laughed, surprisingly deep and lewd.
"A boy, then?"
"No, no. Composure, Lindsay. Your sister, no doubt."
"What?"
"Wrong thing to say."
"American joke. She a friend of yours?"
"Good friend. Good fuck. 50 dirham. Scott sighed. 10. Eventually they settled on 32.
Abdul to wait outside until Scott needed his services as a guide again. Abdul took him to a caftan shop where he spoke in whispers with the fat owner and gave him part of the money. They led Lindsay to the rear of the place behind a curtain. A woman sat on her heels beside the bed, patiently crocheting. She stood up gracelessly. She was short and slight, the top of her head barely reaching Scott's shoulders, and was dressed in traditional costume, lower part of the face veiled, dark blue caftan reaching her ankles. At a command from the owner, she hiked the caftan up around her hips and sat down on the bed with her legs spread apart.
"You see, very clean," Abdul said.
She was the skinniest woman Scott had ever seen naked, partially naked, her pelvic girdle prominent under smooth brown skin. She had very little pubic hair, and the lips of her vulva were dry and gray. But she was only in her early teens, Scott estimated. That and the bizarre prospect of screwing a fully clothed, masked stranger stimulated him instantly, urgently.
"All right," he said, hoarse. "I'll meet you outside."
She watched with alert curiosity as he fumbled with the condom package, and the only sound she made throughout their encounter was to giggle when he fitted the device over his penis. It was manufactured to accommodate the complete range of possible sizes, and on Scott it had a couple of inches to spare. This wonder condom, first-class special delivery French letter, is coated with a fluid so similar to natural female secretions, so perfectly intermissible and isotonic that it could fool the inside of a vagina. But Scott's ran out of juice in seconds, and the aloof lady's physiology didn't supply any replacement. So he had to fall back on saliva and an old familiar fantasy. It was a long, dry hall, the bedding straw crunching monotonously under them, she constantly shifting to more comfortable positions as he angrily pressed his weight into her, finally a draining that was more hydrostatics than passion, which left him jumpy rather than satisfied. When he rolled off her, the condom stayed put, there being more lubrication inside it than out. The woman extracted it, and out of some obscure motive, twisted a knot in the end and dropped it behind the bed. When he'd finished dressing, she held out her hand for a tip. He laughed and told her in English that he was the one who ought to be paid. He'd done all the work. But gave her 5 dirham anyhow for the first rush of excitement and her vulnerable eyes. Abdul was not waiting for him. He tried to interrogate the caftan dealer in French, but got only an interesting spectrum of shrugs. He stepped out onto the street, saw no trace of the little scoundrel, went back inside and gave the dealer a 5 while asking the way to Juma El Fana. He nodded once and wrote it down on a slip of paper in clear copybook English.
"You speak English?"
"No," he said with an Oxford vowel. Scott threaded his way through the maze of narrow streets, carefully memorizing the appearance of each corner in case he had to backtrack. No street was identified by name. The sun was down far enough for the Medina to be completely in shadow, and it was getting cooler. He stopped at a counter to drink a bottle of beer, and a pleasant lassitude fell over him, the first time he had not felt keyed up since the Casablanca airport. He strolled on, taking a left at the corner of dye shop and motor scooter. Halfway down the street, Abdul stood with 7 or 8 other boys, chattering away, laughing. Scott half ran toward the group, and Abdul looked up, startled, when he roared, "You little bastard!" But Abdul only smiled and muttered something to his companions, and all of them rushed him. Not a violent man by any means, Scott had nevertheless suffered enough at the hands of this boy, and he planted his feet, balled his fists, bared his teeth, and listened with his whole body to the sweet singing adrenaline. He'd had 12 hours of hand-to-hand combat instruction and basic training, the first rule of which, if you're outnumbered, run, he ignored, the second rule of which, kick, don't punch, he forgot, and swung a satisfying roundhouse into the first face that came within reach, breaking lips and teeth and one knuckle, he would realize later. Then essayed a side kick to the groin, which only hit a hip, but did put the victim out of the fray. Touched the ground for balance, and bounced up, shaking a child off his right arm while swinging his left at Abdul's neck and missing. Another side kick, this time straight to a kidney, producing a good loud shriek. Abdul hanging out of reach, boys all over him, kicking, punching, finally dragging him to his knees. Abdul stepping forward and kicking him in the chest, then the solar plexus. The taste of dust as someone keeps kicking his head. Losing it, fading out as someone takes his wallet, then from the other pocket his traveler's checks. Lindsay, tell them to leave the checks. They can't. Nobody will. Just doing it to annoy me. Fuck them. It was raining and singing. He opened one eye and saw dark brown. His tongue was flat on the dirt. Interesting, crunchy dirt taste in his mouth. Lindsay, reel in your tongue. This is stupid. People piss in this street. Raining and singing. I have died and gone to Marrakesh. He slid forearm and elbow under his chest and pushed up a few inches. An irregular stain of blood caked the dust in front of him, and blood was why he couldn't open the other eye. He wiped the mud off his tongue with his sleeve, then used the other sleeve to unstick his eyelid. The rain was a wrinkled old woman without a veil, patiently sprinkling water on his head from a pitcher, looking very old and sad. When he sat up, she offered him two white tablets with the letter A impressed on them, and a glass of the same water. He took them gratefully, gagged on them, used another glass of water to wash them farther down, thanked the impassive woman in three languages, hoped it was bottled water, stood up shakily, sledgehammer headache. The slip of paper with directions lay crumpled in the dust, scuffed but still legible. He continued on his way. The singing was a muezzin calling the faithful to prayer. He could hear others singing in more distant parts of the city. Should he take off his hat? No hat. Some natives were simply walking around, going about their business. An old man was prostrate on a prayer rug in the middle of the street. Scott tiptoed around him. He came out of the Medina through a different gate, and the Jama el-Fana was spread out in front of him in all its early evening frenzy. A troop of black dancers did amazing things to machine-gun drum rhythms. Acrobats formed high, shaky pyramids, dropped, reformed. People sang, shouted, laughed. He watched a snake handler for a long time, going through a creepy repertoire of cobras, vipers, scorpions, tarantulas. He dropped a half-dirham in the man's cup and went on. A large, loud group was crowded around a bedsheet-sized game board where roosters strutted from one chalked area to another, pecking at a vase of plastic flowers here, a broken doll there, a painted tin can or torn deck of playing cards elsewhere. Men laying down incomprehensible bets, collecting money, shouting at the roosters, "Baby needs a new pair of sandals." Then a quiet, patient line, men and women squatting, waiting for the services of a healer. The woman being treated had her dress tucked modestly between her thighs, back bared from shoulders to buttocks, while the healer burned angry welts in a symmetrical pattern with the smoldering end of a length of clothesline, and Scott walked on, charmed in the old sense of the word, hypnotized. People shrank from his bloody face, and he laughed at them, feeling like part of the show, then feeling like something apart, a visitation. Drifting down the rows of merchants, leather, brass, ceramics, carvings, textiles, books, junk, blankets, weapons, hardware, jewelry, food. Stopping to buy a bag of green pistachio nuts. The vendor gives him the bag and then waves him away, flapping. No pay, just leave. Gathering darkness, and most of the merchants closed their tents, but the thousands of people didn't leave the square. They moved in around men, perhaps a dozen of them, who sat on blankets scattered around the square in the flickering light of kerosene lanterns, droning the same sing-song words over and over. Scott moved to the closest and shouldered his way to the edge of the blanket and squatted there, an American gargoyle staring. Most of the people gave him room, but light fingers tested his hip pocket. He swatted the hand away without looking back. The man in the center of the blanket fixed on his bloody stare and smiled back, a tight smile, eyes bright with excitement. He raised both arms and the crowd fell silent, switched off. 100 people breathed in at once, when he whispered the first words, barely audible words that must have been the Arabic equivalent of once upon a time. And then the storyteller shouted and began to pace back and forth, playing out his tale in a dramatic staccato voice, waving his arms, hugging himself, whispering, moaning. And Lindsay followed it perfectly, laughing on cue, crying when the storyteller cried, understanding nothing and everything. When it was over, the man held out his cap first to the big American with the bloody face, and Scott emptied his left pocket into the cap. Dirham and half-dirham pieces, and leftover francs, and one rogue dime. And he stood up and turned around and watched his long, broad shadow dance over the crowd as the storyteller with his lantern moved on around the blanket, and he spotted his hotel and pushed toward it through the mob. It was worth it. The magic was worth the pain and humiliation. He forced himself to think of practical things as he approached the hotel. He had no money, no credit cards, no traveler's checks, no identification. Should he go to the police? Probably it would be best to go to American Express first. Collect phone call to the office. Have some money wired. Identity established, so he could have the checks replaced. Police here unlikely to help unless tipped. Ah, simplicity. He did have identification, his passport that he'd left at the hotel desk. That had been annoying, now a lifesaver. Numbers of traveler's checks in his suitcase. There was a woman in the dusty, dim lobby of the hotel. He walked right by her, and she whispered, "Lindsay." He remembered the eyes and stopped. "What do you want?" "I have something of yours." Absurdly, he thought of the knotted condom. But what she held up was a $50 traveler's check. He snatched it from her. She didn't attempt to stop him. "You signed that to me," she said. "I bring you everything else the boys took."
"Even the money?"
He had had over 500 dirhams in cash.
"What they gave me, I bring you."
"Well, you bring it here and we'll see."
She shook her head angrily.
"No, I bring you. I bring you to it. Right now. You sign that to me."
He was tempted.
"At the captain's shop?"
"That's right. Wallet and American Express check. You come."
The Medina at night. A little sense emerged.
"Not now. I'll come with you in the morning."
"Come now."
"I'll see you here in the morning."
He turned and walked up the stairs. Well, he had 50 out of the $1,200. He checked the suitcase, and the list of numbers was where he'd remembered. If she wasn't there in the morning, he would be able to survive the loss. He caressed the dry leather sheath of the antique dagger he'd bought in the Paris flea market. If she was waiting, he would go into the Medina armed. It would simplify things to have the credit cards. He fell asleep and had violent dreams. He woke at dawn, washed up, and shaved. The apparition that peered back from the mirror looked worse than he felt. He was still more exhilarated than otherwise. He took a healing drink of brandy and stuck the dagger in his belt, in the back, so he wouldn't have to button his sport coat. The muezzin's morning wail stopped. She was sitting in the lobby's only chair and stood when he came down the stairs.
"No tricks," he said. "If you have what you say, you get the $50.
They went out of the hotel and the air was almost cool. Damp smell of garbage. "Why did the boys give this to you?"
"Not give. Business deal. I get half."
There was no magic in the Jama'a El-Fana in the morning, just dozens of people walking through the dust. They entered the Medina, and it was likewise bereft of mystery and danger. Sleepy collection of closed-off shop fronts, everything beaded with dew, quiet and stinking. She led him back the way he had come yesterday afternoon. Passing the alley where he had encountered the boys, he noticed there was no sign of blood. Had the old woman neatly cleaned up, or was it simply scuffed away on the sandals of negligent passers-by? Thinking about the fight, he touched the dagger, loosening it in its sheath. Not for the first time, he wondered whether he was walking into a trap. He almost hoped so. But all he had left of value was his signature. Lindsay had gotten combat pay in Vietnam, but the closest he'd come to fighting was to sit in a bunker while mortars and rockets slammed around in the night. He'd never fired a shot in anger, never seen a dead man, never this, never that, and he vaguely felt unproven. The press of the knife both comforted and frightened him. They entered the captain's shop, Lindsay careful to leave the door open behind them. The fat captain dealer was seated behind a table. On the table were Lindsay's wallet and a china plate with a small pile of dried mud. The dealer watched impassively while Lindsay snatched up his wallet. "The checks." The dealer nodded. "I have a proposition for you. You've learned English. I believe I have something you would like to buy with those checks." Lindsay jerked out the dagger and pointed it at the man's neck. His hand and voice shook with rage. "I'll cut your throat first. Honest to God, I will." There was a childish giggle, and the curtain to the bedroom parted, revealing Abdul with a pistol. The pistol was so large he had to hold it with both hands, but he held it steadily, aimed at Lindsay's chest. "Drop the knife," the dealer said. Lindsay didn't. "This won't work. Not even here. A merchant has a right to protect himself." "That's not what I mean. You can kill me, I know, but you can't force me to sign those checks at gunpoint. I will not do it." He chuckled. "That is not what I had in mind. Not at all. I truly do have something to sell you, something beyond worth. The gun is only for my protection. I assumed you were wise enough to come armed. Relinquish the knife, and Abdul will leave." Lindsay hesitated, weighing obscure odds, balancing the will to live against his newly born passion. He dropped the dagger. The merchant said something in Arabic while the prostitute picked up the knife and set it on the table. Abdul emerged from the room with no gun and two straight wooden chairs. He set one next to the table and one behind Lindsay and left, slamming the door. "Please sign the check you have and give it to the woman. You promised." He signed it and asked in a shaking voice, "What do you have that you think I'll pay $1,200 for?" The woman reached into her skirts and pulled out the tied-up condom. She dropped it on the plate. "This," he said, "your blood and seed." With the point of the dagger, he opened the condom and its contents spilled into the dirt. He stirred them into mud. "You are a modern man." "What kind of mumbo-jumbo?" "A modern man who certainly doesn't believe in magic. Are you Christian?" "Yes." "No." He was born Baptist, but hadn't gone inside a church since he was 18. He nodded. "I was confident the boys could bring back some of your blood last night. More than I needed, really." He dipped his thumb in the vile mud and smeared a rough cross on the woman's forehead. "I can't believe this." "But you can." He held out a small piece of string. "This is a symbolic restraint." He laid it over the glob of mud and pressed down on it. Lindsay felt himself being pushed back into the chair. Cold sweat peppered his back and palms. "Try to get up." "Why should I?" Lindsay said, trying to control his voice. "I find this fascinating." "Insane, Lindsay. Voodoo only works on people who believe in it. Psychosomatic." "It gets even better." He reached into a drawer and pulled out Lindsay's checkbook, opened it, and set it in front of Lindsay with a pen. "Sign." "Get up, get up." "No." He took four long, sharp needles out of the drawer and began talking in a low monotone, mostly Arabic, but some nonsense English. The woman's eyes drooped half shut, and she slumped in the chair. "Now," he said in a normal voice, "I can do anything to this woman, and she won't feel it. You will." He pulled up her left sleeve and pinched her arm. "Do you feel like writing your name?" Lindsay tried to ignore the feeling. You can't hypnotize an unwilling subject. Get up, get up, get up. The man ran a needle into the woman's left triceps. Lindsay flinched and cried out, "Deny him. Get up." He murmured something, and the woman lifted her veil and stuck out her tongue, which was long and stained blue. He drove a needle through it, and Lindsay's chin jerked back onto his chest, tongue on fire, bile foaming up in his throat. His right hand scrabbled for the pen, and the man withdrew the needles. He scrawled his name on the 50s and 100s. The merchant took them wordlessly and went to the door. He came back with Abdul, armed again. "I am going to the bank. When I return, you will be free to go." He lifted the piece of string out of the mud. "In the meantime, you may do as you wish with this woman. She is being paid well. I advise you not to hurt her, of course." Lindsay pushed her into the back room. It wasn't proper rape, since she didn't resist, but whatever it was, he did it twice and was sore for a week. He left her there and sat at the merchant's table, glaring at Abdul. When he came back, the merchant told Lindsay to gather up the mud and hold it in his hand for at least a half hour, and get out of Marrakesh. Out in the bright sun, he felt silly with the handful of crud, and ineffably angry with himself, and he flung it away and rubbed the offended hand in the dirt. He got a couple of $100 on his credit cards at an outrageous rate of exchange, and got the first train back to Casablanca and the first plane back to the United States, where he found himself to be infected with gonorrhea, and over the next few months paid a psychotherapist and a hypnotist over $2,000 and nevertheless felt rotten for no organic reason. And 9 months later lay on an examining table in the emergency room of Suburban Hospital with terrible abdominal pains of apparently psychogenic origin, not responding to muscle relaxants or tranquilizers, while a doctor and two aides watched in helpless horror as his own muscles cracked his pelvic girdle into sharp knives of bone, and his child was born without pain 4,000 miles away.